Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. One in three bites of everything we eat is made possible by honeybee pollination. We wouldn't have the flavor or the nutrition in almonds, berries, fruits, and vegetables without these pollinators. The food on our table and our landscapes depend on them. But honeybees, wild bees, and butterflies are disappearing. Over the last year, we've lost 43% of bee colonies. Scientists say bees are disappearing because of parasites that are attacking them, pesticides, and food. Bees are running out of nutrition because of crop farming, and the number of butterflies are dropping too. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about why bees and butterflies are disappearing and how are these declines affecting our food supply and our landscapes. Today we're joined by Dr. Eric Musson. He served for 38 years as extension apiculturist in the UC Davis Department of Entomology. He retired last June. Eric served as a liaison between academic researchers and beekeepers to promote bee health. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Ellen Zagary. Ellen served as Director of Public Horticulture at UC Davis's Arboretum and Public Gardens for more than 20 years. Ellen develops educational programs on how to design gardens that attract wildlife. Hi, Ellen. Welcome back to the show. Nice to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Eric, let's start off with you. We did a show about this, I think it was more than 6 months ago. This issue was getting so much attention last year. It has kind of died down since then. But according to reports, over the last year, we have lost 43% of bee colonies. So if we first talk about bees, what are we facing today?
Well, if you simply look at the statistics of the losses, it would sound like within a couple of years we'd be down to zero. But the truth of the matter is that the bees have a wonderful regenerative system, and we can take the larger colonies and knock them down into smaller ones and allow them enough time to build back up again, and we keep our numbers. So if you look at the annual numbers of colonies in the United States that are reported to the federal government, it seems like over the last 5 years, despite all these numbers of colony losses that we've had, still the average number is holding pretty much steady. So that just means that we're able to take many of them that fortunately didn't give in and split them up and get our numbers back.
How do they regenerate?
Well, they have a capacity to really build up a population fast when they need to, because the queen honeybee, if she's well fed, can lay 2,000 eggs a day. 21 days later, you're going to get 2,000 bees emerging, and they will last for approximately 6 weeks in the summertime and up to 6 months in the winter. So, you know, you can build a big population fairly quickly with that number of new bees coming aboard. And that's about the only thing actually is keeping us from sinking.
And Eric, if you can move just a bit away from your microphone.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you. And Ellen, the last time we did the show, we had a lot of people call in with their personal experiences. And like my mom has a lot of lavender. And about 5 years ago, we saw so many bees in the backyard and the front yard. And we just don't see that anymore. Is that what you're hearing from people? I mean, what are people's personal experiences in terms of their interactions with bees in their own yards?
Well, I have to say that that certainly is not true in my yard, but I'm one of the people that decided to take the drought seriously, and I ripped out my lawn, and I put in mixed plantings with lots of different kinds of nectar plants, things with flowers, things that produce pollen as well, and I have a lot of honeybees here in Davis in my front yard. That could be partly because there are many people around here that keep hives also.
Okay.
But for most people, I think it's just making the change to having more diverse plantings around them. And then if everyone does that, we just could increase the overall diversity of our landscapes.
And so what is your assessment of what we're facing right now? Because when we read that we've lost 43% of bee colonies in the past year, that sounds pretty dire. But then Eric says that they do such a good job of regenerating.
Well, I'm not a bee, especially not a honeybee expert, but I'm not a bee expert. I'm really a plant person. So I would defer to Dr. Musin on that. But one of the things that we like people to become aware of is the 1,600 species of native bees that in the state of California, we have a lot of native bees, and some of them are also very good pollinators. And I'm trying to get people to be more aware of the importance of those native animals.
And Eric, what explains the collapse? Time magazine had a really good video that just explained what's happening. And the scientists they interviewed point to three different things. And that is pesticides. We're already receiving a few emails about pesticides, about parasites that are attacking the bees, and then food. Bees are running out of nutrition because of massive crop farming in the United States.
Well, in some respects, all of those are correct. We seem to be losing our bees because of a combination of things. It's like death by a thousand cuts. And the most important one actually is the food. Just like you and me, if the bees can't get the nutrition that they need, then it's likely that they're going to have problems with either infections or parasites or exposure to toxic chemicals. If they're not healthy to begin with, then they don't hold on very well. That being said, one would assume that many of these losses, percentage-wise, that are high, are only in the commercial bees. And that's not true. If you look at the Bee-Informed Partnership website, they take an annual survey of beekeepers across the country. And although not a whole lot of commercial beekeepers tend to respond, the small-scale beekeepers respond in significant numbers, really significant. And there are places, in especially in the eastern states of the U.S., where the small-scale beekeepers are averaging a 50% loss of their colonies.
Wow.
And they're not out in the ag areas. So it isn't just ag areas. It's all these little things that are stressing the bees that cause them to basically give it up and fly off. And that's called CCD. But, you know, we don't even have beekeepers reporting very much CCD now either. The last couple of years, I think the beekeepers have said, well, I think the mites were responsible for this and starvation was responsible for that. And I think it's gotten down to the point where CCD, where the bees just fly off for reasons we don't understand at all, is down to 7% of an estimate of why they're losing their bees.
Heather Matilla, a honeybee biologist at Wellesley, told Time that unfortunately a country once filled with meadows of diverse pollen-packed wildflowers is now blanketed by crops, manicured lawns, and mown fields barren of pollen sources. She says, quote, a green space can be a green desert if it doesn't have flowering plants that are bee-friendly, and bees need a varied diet of different pollens in order to grow into strong and healthy workers. So that's part of the problem, right?
Well, yes, that is part of the problem. In order for bees to be healthy, they can't just have a lot of one kind of flower out there that produces nectar and pollen. They have to have a real mix of pollens because there's a lot of micronutrients that only exist in some pollens and not others. And so if they can get this nice blend of pollens coming in, they can cover all their micronutrients and then they can get their best nutrition. So it is true that as we take places that used to have either wildflowers or weeds, it doesn't really matter to the bees, and cover them over with cement and with houses and with airports and whatever, we are just reducing by far how much food they can get.
And Ellen, what do you tell people who are changing their gardens because of the drought, people who really care about making sure that bees have something to eat in their gardens?
Well, it's actually advantageous to consider using plants that are native to California because they're going to, in most cases, be better adapted to hot, dry summers. And also the native California plants would have evolved with native insects here, so they may have a function where they can be utilized by those native insects. I personally like to mix the California natives with plants from other Mediterranean regions because they have that same adaptation to summer heat and drought, but also you can get more evergreen quality and more of a permanent landscape rather than, I mean, I'm not one who wants a field of weeds. I'm like, I want to manicure it. It's my landscape. I want it to look really pretty all the time.
Ellen Zachary has served as Director of Public Horticulture at UC Davis's Arboretum and Public Gardens for more than 20 years, and she develops programs on how to design gardens that attract wildlife. Dr. Eric Musson served for 38 years as Extension Apiculturist in the UC Davis Department of Entomology. He served as a liaison between academic researchers and beekeepers to promote bee health. Today we are talking about why bees and butterflies are disappearing. We're talking about how they regenerate, how this is affecting our landscapes and our food supply. And we talked about this colony collapse disorder, and that happens when a hive's adult bees disappear, leaving behind the queen and immature bees that do not survive. Over the last year, we've lost 43% of bee colonies, but Eric says they do an amazing job of regenerating. So if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about what you're seeing in your garden, give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then, of course, the larger issues, what happens when bees and butterflies disappear. If you have any questions or comments about that, so much of our fruit and vegetables depend on bees. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk a little bit about the pesticides, because over the weekend I got a bunch of emails from listeners who wanted us to talk about pesticides. Eric, mm-hmm. The pesticides got a lot of attention last year, and there's a new study out of Newcastle University, and it found that bees are actually becoming addicted to pesticides. A story out of The National says, like nicotine for humans, certain pesticides seem to hold an addictive attraction for bees, which seek out tainted food, even if it may be bad for them.
That's an interesting study. We also know that honeybees, if they can find nectar with caffeine in it, prefer that too. So it appears that, yes, indeed, there is some chemistry out there that might be able to attract pollinators to particular plants. You know, it's when we start talking about pesticides in its broadest stroke, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about insecticides, miticides, herbicides, fungicides, any kind of a side, that C-I-D-E means that they're designed to kill. And so under the circumstances, once a bee or you and I or anything becomes comes in contact with those, you're exposed, you've got a certain amount of it with you, and we have to detoxify that. And so under the circumstances, no matter what pesticide residue or pesticide the bee runs into in the field, it's going to have to take part of its energy and use it to detoxify that exposure. So if you add that on top of the fact that they're not very well nourished, now you've got a bee that's spending a lot of energy detoxifying things. It's not in too good shape. And then you superimpose over that some of these parasites and the newer diseases and older diseases that the bees have. It just sort of gangs up on them. So although some people think that a particular pesticide probably is the worst of the bunch, and they do differ in various ways, the truth of the matter is that any of these pesticides are going to have a negative impact on the physiology of the bee, even when they're exposed to low concentrations.
And neonicotinoids are the pesticides that are getting the most attention. The EU has restricted the use of these pesticides, but they're still used on farms in the United States. In April, the EPA said it would halt the expanded use of this class of insecticides. Portland just became the latest city to ban these pesticides. And then 8 other cities, including Seattle, have similar bans. What are your thoughts on that, Eric?
Well, I don't get bothered when certain pesticides get removed from a bee's diet, but you have to consider what's going on out there. The big difference between the neonicotinoids and the other materials that the bees used to encounter was in the bad old days of pyrethroids, carbamates, organophosphates. Those applications were made on the crop or whatever they got onto, the weeds that the bees got into, and for a few days We had dead bees for a few days. We had contaminated pollen, and the whole thing basically went away. I mean, some of that old pollen was still going to hang around in the colony. One of the things about the neonics that are different is that the material is picked up by the plant, no matter how it got it in the first place, is spread throughout the plant. And if the plant blooms, it's very likely that very low concentrations are going to come out in the nectar and the pollen. So what's the difference with the exposure? Well, the amount the bees are exposed to in the nectar and pollen generally are not enough to harm the adult bees. So they do collect nectar and pollen that's contaminated and bring it back to the hive. One of the substantial differences is it's not a 2 or a 3 day situation. The nectar and pollen are going to be contaminated the whole time that whatever that plant is in bloom. So you have bees going out and collecting it and bringing it back, perhaps storing it for later use by the hive and whatnot, not in huge concentrations, but overall everything just gets contaminated, and it stays contaminated for a long time. So that's one of the differences. And now the next question is, so those quite sublethal doses, what impact do they really have on the bees and the bee colony? And there have been experiments done that show, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that very low concentrations of these materials do change behavior, memory, physical abilities of the bees and whatnot when they're way sublethal. No question about it. But interestingly, if you look back at some of the pyrethroids and some of these other materials, if you give them low concentrations, the bees don't do so well either. So I'm not sure that they're that much different in their effects on the bees as such, but that's that whole idea of having such a prolonged period of time and picking that material up and bringing it back to the colony, it definitely makes them different from exposures to the other materials.
And also the Fish and Wildlife Service will prohibit the use of these neonicotinoids at national wildlife refuges by next January. And then a quick question on this for you, Ellen. We got an email from Alex who says, I was heartsick when I found out about a year or so ago that growers of garden plants that are sold in retail nurseries are selling bee-friendly plants have been treated with these neonics. And she says, I'd like to encourage listeners who buy garden plants, especially if they're trying to provide habitat for bees and butterflies, to do their best to find out from nurseries whether or not their purchases have been treated with neonics and to put pressure on them, to put the pressure on the growers. We're often told, quote, plant for bees and butterflies, but this could be totally self-defeating if we ignore the neonic issue. What are your thoughts on that, Ellen?
Well, we've stopped using any of that class of chemicals in our nursery where we grow plants to raise funds for our educational programming. And it's precisely because of this same issue that I had a big concern, because this was 2 or 3 years ago that we ceased the use of those chemicals, because there wasn't the research done then that has been done now. It was more just like, maybe it's a problem. So we decided to just to be on the safe side. And then I think since then, more and more people have become aware. And I do agree with the listener who wants to ask and inquire. I think that you should do that. You can inquire of your nursery growers if they're using them or not. The one problem might be that the retailers may not know what the wholesalers use. And for someone growing ornamental plants, that chemical is very, very useful, and that you can avoid exposing your workers to pesticides because you can use it as a chemical that you put on the soil, and then it's absorbed up into the plant, and it just sort of works so great. You know, that's the problem. But I think that as we become more conscious of what our gardens do in relation to the environment around us, that we'll need to be asking these questions and trying to see how we can manage our, you know, economic engines so that they don't damage the environment at all.
Right. And Alex also says it's really important to ask, because she says some garden plant wholesale growers have stopped using neonics, others reserve the right, and others insist on using them. Local nurseries buy from so many different growers, they can't really get good information about which plants have or have not been treated, especially in gallon sizes. She says, I've tried contacting growers directly, but have not received replies. So thank you so much for that email and advice, Alex. Thanks for writing in. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Fran in San Francisco. Hi, Fran. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. My question is, I have a garden. I've had a garden for 20 years, and I had many multiple plants to attract bees, and I had bumblebees, hummingbirds, and butterflies. And about 5 years ago, I started getting wasps, rats, blue jays, and mockingbirds. And my garden has completely changed. In fact, I'm so afraid to go out there with the number of wasps that are out there. Can you say anything about that?
Thank you.
I can respond to that, yeah. Wasps are predators, which means that they occasionally will feed on some pollen and nectar, but usually they make their living by going out and finding spiders, caterpillars, crickets, something that they can sting and paralyze and chew them up and bring the larvae back, or they bring the whole spider back, it depends on the species of wasp, and feed that to their brood. So that's the business. And if you haven't used very many pesticides on your property and in your garden and whatnot, then the chances are there's going to be more of this prey there. And if there's more prey, then you're going to have more predators. And we have to think of birds as predators when it comes to insects as well. So if you see more of those in your yard now, it probably means because you're producing a better crop of food for those individuals. And that's why they're there. I think if you're an environmentalist, you'd say, well, that sounds more like the way we want it to work anyway. But I think that's why you're seeing the difference, because there are more things in there now for those predators to feed on.
And Ellen, do you have anything to add to that?
If there was a nest of wasps, what happens is when you get a lot of wasps, if you just stand perfectly still, they don't sting you. My experience has been they don't sting me, because if I swat at them or I move, they might be aggressive. But I would go outside and I would observe and see if you can see that if there's a nest of anything that you're concerned about, because I have to say that there are some wasps that I don't want nesting right by my door, you know, where I'm going to go outside and be out in the garden. So being very selective about how you might control a nest that's a little too close, but then leaving the ones that are farther away to have this ecological function that we've been talking about of being predators and being part of the balance of the environment. But if there's so many that they're intimidating you, you could have a nest.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Fran. Today we are talking about bees. We're also going to talk about butterflies after the break. If you have any questions about why bees are disappearing, if you've seen any changes in your garden, if you work on these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And just quickly, we'll talk more about this after the break. But because bees are so crucial to our food supply, Eric, have we seen any changes as a result of the colony collapses?
I don't believe, at least at this point, that pollination, the ability of getting our bees in the fields where they're needed, when they're needed to get the job done. We had a little bit of a problem with lack of bees back in 2005, 2006, when this CCD thing originated and started getting going. And then I think we were short on bees. But I believe that given a little bit of time and given the beekeepers' ability to pick bees up and move them when they have to, so far, I think, we've been able to cover the pollination needs all across the country.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about bees, and we'll also talk about butterflies after the break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call. On the phone, 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. Or you can write your email question or comment and send it to feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about California's drought. We've done so many shows on water issues, and because we've had such an overwhelming response, we decided to invite Daniel Beard to join us again. He's former commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. When we did our show about agriculture, he often brought the topic back to agriculture, saying that Jerry Brown is giving agriculture a pass on the issue of the drought. So we will talk with him about that tomorrow. We'll also talk about solutions to what we are currently facing. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the state of bees, and then we'll also talk about the state of butterflies. The state of bees has gotten a lot of attention in the media. It's also getting attention from the White House. President Obama and Michelle Obama put a task force together of people to save bees and butterflies. And according to scientists, over the last year, we have lost 43% of bee colonies. But today's guest, Dr. Eric Musson, says they do such a good job of regenerating. Eric served for 38 years as extension apiculturist in the UC Davis Department of Entomology. He served as liaison between academic researchers and beekeepers to promote bee health. He retired last June. Ellen Zagary has served as director of public horticulture at UC Davis's Arboretum and Public Gardens for more than 20 years. And Ellen develops educational programs on how to design gardens that attract wildlife. So if you have any questions about your garden, if you've seen any changes, we'd love to hear from you. And then if you have broader questions about bees and butterflies, why they are disappearing and why they are so important, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm a little concerned that the gentleman may have unduly minimized the role of the nicotinoids because in a report from Great Britain, but cited in the Washington Post just last month, it was pointed out that the word nicotine in nicotinoids is no accident, and that just as with people becoming addicted to nicotine, smokers, that the bees become addicted to the plants that have the nicotinoids on them, and that however poor nutrition those plants may provide compared to other flowers of other plants, the bees will be attracted to them, give them preference because they're addicted to the nicotinoids. And so when we discuss the other factors, one of the problems in discussing other factors, mites and whatever else, is the thing can seem so big that you can feel you can do nothing about it. But it appears to me that the connection between inadequate food sources that were alluded to might very well be significantly due to the fact that the bees aren't going to the sources of adequate food because they're addicted to the nicotinoids that are on the other ones. And I appreciate the comments.
Thank you, William. So we brought that up earlier, and this is a study out of Newcastle University, and then the study was published in the science journal Nature. Eric, you hadn't heard about this. It didn't get that much attention in the U.S., but it's getting a lot of attention overseas.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I heard about it. One of the things that you have to look back into a little bit is you have to look back into the fact that the chemical companies have researchers and scientists who are always trying to outmaneuver the pest insects. And you find out that nicotine is an interesting material because it is toxic to you, it's toxic to me, it's toxic to the honeybees. But you find, with critical looking, that the nervous system of insects is slightly different from the nervous system of humans. And then if you look at what the neonicotinoids have done, we at one time used nicotine for pest control, but we almost controlled as many people as we did pests. I mean, that stuff's really dangerous. So a hunt was on to see whether or not these materials could be modified, nicotine could be modified, made into analogs of various kinds. And the ones that have been used in the neonicotinoids are extremely toxic to invertebrates, which would mean you're insects, but it would also mean a whole bunch of other things that don't have backbones. Whereas mammals, fish, birds don't have very much trouble with it because our nervous system is just that much different from those of invertebrates. And so that was one of the reasons that the selection was made, because it could be focused so specifically on insects. It's just really unfortunate, you know, that a honeybee is an insect. And so it was kind of focused, you know, to be pretty darn hard on them too. Before, when I mentioned that a very, very minor amount of these materials can have a measurable physiological effect on the bees in a laboratory study, when you go out into the field and begin to incorporate these very low levels of material into the diets of the bees to see if you can change what's going on in the colony, occasionally some experiments have suggested that yes, you can. They've seen some different results. But for the most part, somehow or another, the materials at those low levels are just sort of blended into all the rest of the food that's coming in and whatever. And you don't see anywhere near the results on a colony that you see on an individual bee in the lab.
What do you think should be done about this? Because it is kind of amazing when you think that bees are becoming addicted to these neonicotinoids. For example, people are signing petitions urging the Obama administration to ban the use of these pesticides. Lawmakers are pushing for this. The Center for Food Safety wants the president via the EPA to ban the use rather than waiting for Congress to act. What do you think? Do you think the president should do something on this issue, Eric?
Well, if the determination is made that it appears as though those materials are significantly worse for the environment, for honeybees, et cetera, then the alternative, then they can go ahead and shut down the registrations for those materials across the country, and they won't be used anymore. And then all the growers will have to go back to trying to deal with the pest problems with the materials that we previously thought were so bad to use. The systemic materials were sort of sold to the EPA as being better because they were very restricted on where they were placed, and they got up into the plant and did their job in the plant, and you didn't basically, you know, cover the environment with a plane flying and spraying this material all over the place, because that's pretty unfocused on where the materials will go. So that was kind of the logic behind it. Now, whether or not we find out, like we have in the past with DDT and a bunch of other things, that although it really sounded good at first, it doesn't seem to be the best decision in the world, that remains to be seen. But if the neonics are eliminated from agriculture the way we're using them now, they'll have to go back to the pyrethroids, the organophosphates, carbamates, and there'll be a lot more of those materials out in the environment than we certainly have right now.
And do you know, is sulfoxaflor, I'm trying to pronounce that right, sulfoxaflor a neonic?
It's a relative, and it goes systemic in plants, and so, yeah, I guess you could classify it as a neonic as well.
Okay, and I ask because
it's a new one.
Earth yeah. Justice filed a lawsuit last month. They appealed the EPA's approval of sulfoxaflor, and Earth Justice said it is a toxic pesticide shown to kill honeybees. And Ellen, I know you work on the garden side of this, and you really educate people on how to design gardens that attract wildlife. But how do you talk to the public about pesticides?
What we try to get people to think about is, if you have enough diversity and you have lots of flowering plants, you'll have a healthy, diverse insect population. So in other words, you'll have pollinators, but you'll also have predator insects, you'll have parasitic insects, because it's a dog-eat-dog world out there. And once you start having more diverse plants, you'll start having a more diverse population of insects. And there's some effect that we have seen in our gardens where if you plant certain plants, you'll get a greater you get an appearance and a population increase in certain kinds of beneficial insects, things like hoverflies or surfeit flies they're called, and those will eat aphids. So I try to promote diversity That people try to promote these natural systems and to not use pesticides without really considering what the effects are going to be and only using them when they're absolutely necessary. And so in a garden at home, it's really different from a crop that you're growing where you're a farmer and you need to make a living is really basically what it is. We try to get people to tolerate low levels of insect damage in favor of improving their overall biodiversity.
All right. And again, the EU has restricted the use of these neonics. 8 U.S. cities, including Portland and Seattle, have bans. The Federal Fish and Wildlife Service is going to prohibit them for use at national wildlife refuges next January. So thank you for the call, William. And if you'd like to join us today, we are talking about bees. We're also going to talk about butterflies, but we're focusing on bees in the beginning of the show because we have seen such a drop in bee colonies. We've lost 43% of bee colonies over the last year. And when a colony collapse disorder happens, that's when a hive's adult bees disappear, leaving behind the queen and immature bees that do not survive. And we would not have the flavor or the nutrition in so much of what we eat without these pollinators, almonds, berries, fruits, vegetables. So if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about what we're facing and what we can do to make sure that bees and butterflies survive, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any garden questions or what you're seeing in your area, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise. Yes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I first have a question, I think, and that is I lived in a garden for about 10 years, and I had pretty much only native kind of plants, and I have never in my life used a insecticide or any of that sort of stuff. I just let everything go natural. I had lots and lots of bees in this garden, and people would walk past the garden, and I had berries and things also, and they would say, how come you have so many bees here? We don't have bees. Well, anyway, I did have bees. I had to leave that garden. But one of my questions is, how come I never see a beehive any place? Because as far as I know, bees don't travel that incredibly far. But in all my years on the earth, I have never seen a beehive out in the wild, kind of. And I wonder if anybody has time to tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, thank you. Ellen, can you take that one?
Well, I think if it's a question about how far bees fly, it should be Dr. Musin.
Okay. Just to respond, the native pollinators tend to be the ones that stay closer to home. Most of them are ground nesting, and they're taking as short a trip as they can to collect their pollen, get back, and feed their brood in the ground. Honeybees, however, to get that mixed diet that they need, have a much more expansive potential foraging range. And there's two things here to keep in mind. One is they can and do fly up to 4.5 miles away from the hive to collect water and food when the food is short. And that is an area of 50 square miles. So a honeybee colony has the capacity to go out and collect things within a 50-square-mile area, and sometimes they collect things that we wish they didn't get into, particularly if there are ag chemicals being used in that 50-square-mile area. The second thing that you have to keep in mind is when the native bees working from the ground are going out and getting their pollen and bringing it back, they mix pollen and nectar together and they make a little dough ball down in one of their cells. They lay an egg on it, they seal up the cell, and they go out and start the process over again. The honeybees are flying out, and they have to get enough food for that 1,000 to 2,000 larvae per day, new ones per day, that they feed for 6 days. So in order to do that, a honeybee colony, a normal honeybee colony, once it gets going, needs about an acre equivalent of blossoms to be working on. Now, if they luck out and they're just surrounded by some kind of a honey crop plant, that acre will be right outside the door. But sometimes they have to go quite a ways, and they have to have quite a bit, number of bees going in opposite directions, various directions, to get this mix of pollen that they need, an acre equivalent a day of those mixed pollens in order to keep that colony healthy. So you can see what an enormous amount of food a honeybee colony needs compared to the ground nesting bees on an individual basis. But you can have a terrific number of ground nesting bees in some places too, and they will eat a lot of food and they'll pollinate a lot of plants as well.
Do you see many beehives in your area, Eric? Are you in the Sacramento area?
When you see, do we see very many of them, individuals who don't have very many of them will place them in the backyard or somewhere and put them out of view because they're concerns over vandalism. There's concerns over not having people necessarily know where their bees are. If someone gets stung, they might get blamed, and it may or may not have been their bee. But if you begin to go a little bit more out into the countryside, the beekeepers don't have great big huge places where they could just set bees down and leave them there all the time. So they're moving them from one crop to another for pollination. They're trying to get some honey someplace or another. And yes, you will see, if you keep your eyes open when you're driving through the agricultural areas and whatnot, you'll see them. They're just there. But those are in boxes. She's not going to see the ones that are in trees or in somebody's house or whatever, those so-called feral bees. They're just in the neighborhood.
Well, thank you for the question, Marie-Louise. We have a sort of related question from Ruby, who says, do urban bees ever get to the Central Valley and other areas of commercial growing? We have lots of bees, hummingbirds, and butterflies. I'd love to think their activities here, including dropping seeds, which grow plants we don't want to see spread, would have a positive effect on crop areas not in our immediate area.
Well, it's possible if your colony is right on the fringe of an ag area, and there are some places where ag abuts right up to the newer places where the housing has been built and whatnot. If you're a hobby beekeeper and you have one out in the backyard and you're within flight distance of the crop, it could very well be those bees would go out and work on the crop. It also could very well be that some of your bees are going to come back sick from having worked out there in those ag areas. So, yeah, they can make a contribution, but what we're talking about is right now in the state of California, we have about 500,000 commercial colonies that can be used in crop pollination around the state. And then we have a lot of them. We've got a lot of other thousands in the hands of the non-commercial people. Some of those individuals kind of like to generate a little bit of income, so they will put them on the truck with the other beekeepers' bees, take them out, do some almond pollination, because you can get somewhere around $180 to $200 for putting that one colony out there in the almonds. So that kind of makes it worthwhile. And then they'll come back home, put them back in their backyard, and leave them there until the next almond pollination. But most of the smaller scale beekeepers don't even bother to try to move their bees around at all. They just have a place where they put them down and hope that they'll be able to find enough food and water to keep them going.
Almonds have been getting a lot of attention because of the drought. And is it true that in California, the almond industry requires about 1.5 million colonies of honeybees?
Yes, I believe we were up to like 860,000 acres or something like that this last season. And we need two colonies per acre as an average of honeybees for those. So, yeah, 1.5 million colonies of bees in California now, each February, March.
Ruby also says, what is the deal with huge swarms of bees that come, buzz en masse for 10 minutes or so, and then move on? She says, what do they want? It's very cinematic.
If she's seeing large groups of bees like that in the air kind of swirling around like they don't know where they're going, but they do kind of move along as a cloud, that's generally a swarm. That's colony reproduction. You know, you're going to lose some colonies, so there has to be a way that the colonies can try to keep their numbers up. So the old queen and half the bees fly off and try to find a new place to settle down and set up a new colony. Before they leave, they have reared some new queens, daughter queens, and one of those is going to take over the old colony and keep it going. And then we've got two functional colonies if things work the way they're supposed to.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Ruby. We've got a number of callers on the line. Let's hear from John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I've been a beekeeper in San Francisco for about 10 years, and I've had a few of my colonies, which I don't have very many, you know, disappear with nothing but honey and one queen left. And I'm just wondering if the bees can find, you know, there's a landmine study that a bee can find a landmine 2 miles away, and they can sense parts per trillion. How does a bee find these neonicotinoids? I mean, where do they go get them? Are they just smoking nicotine, or what are they doing? I mean, how do they get it?
Okay, I don't believe that the bees, you know, smell the nicotine and run off to that. If indeed bees are becoming attracted to in larger numbers to plants that have been sprayed or somehow treated with neonicotines, that generally would be because the bee that went there and foraged on it brought it back and kind of shared it with some more naive bees that didn't know what they were up to, and they said, oh, I'll go get that. And you're right. They have an exquisite sense of smell, just about as good as a dog from what we understand. So once they find that material, they'll go track it down mostly by odor. And under those circumstances, you know, whatever the odor of the pollen in a plant and even sometimes the habitat in which it's growing, that odor comes back on these bees, and then other bees can follow that back out and end up at the same place. So I think that's how more bees can end up on those treated plants. Not, I don't think that they actually smell the trace chemical, and that's part of the attractiveness.
All right. Thank you for the call, John. Let's go next to Donna in San Francisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi there. I have a question about backyard gardening. I have a variety of flowers in my backyard, including honeywort and sweet pea and my tomatoes and other crops growing, blueberries included. I don't seem to get honeybees. I get bumblebees, I get sweat bees, I get orange rump bees, I get hoverflies. I even planted a verbascum that I saw growing in the arboretum that attracted honeybees there, but I don't seem to get them, even though there's a honeybee hive near my house. There's a, by our community garden, there's a couple of boxed bee colonies, and I was curious to know about specifically attracting them. I don't seem to get them.
All right, Ellen, well, do you want to take, or go ahead, Eric,
I'm
and
sorry,
then Ellen.
Okay, honeybees set up a priority list. And whatever it is that they're going out and getting, they bring it back to the hive. Other bees come and pay attention to it. And if it's attractive to the rest of the bees, they form these little subpopulations and go out and use that crop. However, given everything that's out there, apparently there is something or some things more attractive to honeybees in that flight distance and direction that we're talking about out there than the crops in this particular lady's property. So the bees prioritize, and what she has in her garden are not high priority for honeybees, which is probably good because it leaves the food there for the rest of the bees.
Yeah, I think it's a really great thing that she has all those other kinds of bees, and they're pollinators as well. So one thing about tomatoes I've recently remembered and been reminded of is that you have to have bumblebees because you need to have buzz pollination. They require a certain kind. So to get tomatoes, you want to have bumblebees. But what I have found for honeybees, that probably the most popular plants that I grow are things that are from the Mediterranean region, which, of course, they're called European honeybees. They came from Europe originally, and so it makes sense that they would have evolved originally in association with Mediterranean plants like lavenders and oregano, thyme. So maybe trying to put more of those kinds of things around your vegetable garden might be of help.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. Thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Anna in Santa Cruz. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the show. Hi, Anna. Go ahead.
Sorry. Hi. About the traveling bees that get put on trucks and taken from different places to the Central Valley. In Santa Cruz, I have a few friends who are, you know, beekeepers and who are doing that, taking, you know, 1,000 bee boxes to the Central Valley. What is the effect on bees of that, since they're used to, you know, they're local? I mean, has there been studies done on how that might be affecting the actual bees and bee colonies themselves?
Yeah, that's a great
travel around?
Great question. Thank you. Eric, do we know?
Well, they've put some sensors, humidity sensors and temperature sensors in these bee colonies where they're in the trucks to see whether or not something changes. And it disturbs them to a certain extent. The CO2 concentration goes up a little. The temperatures get a little bit warmer. But the interesting thing is, despite the fact that you've just taken bees out of an area where they had a pretty good idea of what was going on in the environment, and you plunked them down somewhere else. I know when I was learning about bees at the University of Minnesota, we didn't have all these fancy trucks and everything, but we could put them on the back of a flatbed and take them somewhere, but we had to unload by hand. So it took us a while to do it, and we'd put the first few colonies down, and then we'd continue to work and continue to work. And it wasn't uncommon that by the time we got all of them off the truck, the ones that were from the first colonies, some of them had already gone out, found a pollen source that they liked, loaded up with pollen, and were flying back with pollen. So it really doesn't appear that the movement of the bees really impacts them that much. They're just going to have to start over. They're all going to have to be scout bees. They can't be habituated foragers anymore because they don't know where they are. So they kind of all have to start out as scout bees, fly out into the environment, check out what plants are out there, bring back the nectar and pollen, see if the ones in the hive like it or don't like it, and set up those patterns of going at the top priority plants first. It just seems to work itself out in a couple of days.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Anna. Final thoughts from you, Ellen. We have about 30 seconds.
Well, I think it's really great that people are aware of the collapse of bees and that they are worried about their environment and that they want to do the right thing. And I think that it's important to look at science-based information and to have people like Dr. Musson's advice on what's the best things to do, because they actually read the science and they know the scientific results.
Ellen Zagary has served as Public Director of Public Horticulture at UC Davis's Arboretum and Public Gardens for more than 20 years, and Dr. Eric Musson served for 38 years as Extension Apiculturist in the UC Davis Department of Entomology. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. The solutions to California's drought. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Daniel Beard, former commissioner of the UC Bureau of Reclamation. January was the driest month in the state since record keeping began in 1895. Wells are running dry, and the Sierra snowpack is far below normal. So how is the state responding to this rapidly growing crisis? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.